How many stars form in our galaxy per Earth year? That is, once the Earth does one lap around the sun, what's the number of new stars that will have formed somewhere in the galaxy since it was last at the place it is now? Astronomers aren't quite sure, and answers vary a lot. Most of the estimates I've seen are between 1.5 and 3 solar masses worth of star, which, since the average star is half the size of the sun, means that 6 stars from the upper bound or 3 stars from the lower bound are created over the course of an average year somewhere in the Milky Way. Let's pick a number and run with it. I'll say 2 solar masses, so 4 stars per year. That's the first term of our equation, 4. Trust me, I'm going somewhere. Next, how many stars have planets? Well, since the discovery of the first exoplanets in 1992, we've found planets around almost every star we've looked for planets around. It's now thought that planets are basically universal. The formation of planets out of a leftover cloud of dust and gas around a newly formed star is an important part of a star's evolution. So the probability that a star will be orbited by planets is pretty close to 1. That's the second term of our equation, 1. Now, we're getting into the iffy terms, and this one might be the iffiest. How many habitable planets does the average star have? Well, really depends on what your definition of habitable is. Does it mean planets in the habitable zone, not too far and not too close to the star? That's right about 0.4. About 40% of stars are believed to have a planet in the habitable zone. But our solar system is an overachiever because it has 2. Mars is also considered to be within the habitable zone. Should Mars be deemed habitable for the purpose of this calculation? How low are we going to set the bar for habitability? How about Jupiter's moons? They're not in the habitable zone, or even planets. But a lot of astronomers say they're the best bet for life outside Earth in our solar system, since a few of them have liquid water oceans and potential sources of complex organic molecules. Should we toss them in the habitable pile? Are they more habitable or less habitable than Mars? Is Venus habitable? Sure, it's hellishly hot and toxic, but when phosphine, a gas created by biological processes, was supposedly discovered in Venus's upper atmosphere a couple of years ago, astronomers said there could well be microscopic life floating around up there. Now, there isn't really any phosphine on or above Venus. The study that claimed to discover it was flawed. But there could still be microscopic life floating around up there. There isn't any evidence for it, but there isn't any evidence against it. So should the bar be that low? Should the criteria for habitability be it's not completely impossible for any life to ever exist there? I don't think so. I'm gonna go out on a limb and say that habitable means some planets in the habitable zone, but not all of them, and maybe some other planets and some moons too. And I'll assign it a value of 1. By this haziest of definitions, every star system has an average of 1 habitable planet. Here's another really fun, really iffy question. Of the planets we've already established to be habitable, how many of them actually evolve life? Now, this has a concrete, undisputable, well, less disputable definition, but we're absolutely in the dark about what the answer is because we're going off a sample size of 1. My intuition says it should be a pretty low number. After all, Earth took 2 billion years to create life. The planet really had to reach an ideal set of conditions, and it's believed that life only originated in one place. So, even when the conditions for life were seemingly absolutely perfect, life evolved once and only once on Earth. That suggests it's a fluke of mind-boggling proportions. And keep in mind that all the ways that Earth is relatively unique compared to other planets we've discovered. We have an unusually large moon for a planet our size, a relic of a nasty collision in Earth's early milky days. We have several very large planets further out in our solar system, beyond the habitable zone. Oh yeah, and we have life. It's been speculated that all these things are directly related. Because Earth has such a big moon, we have tides, and life may have begun in tide pools. Because Jupiter and Saturn have so much gravity, not a lot of asteroids hit Earth. Because they get pulled into orbit around the gas giants, that definitely makes our planet more habitable. And when you consider what other factors could have been in play, the Earth tilts, so it has seasons, the Earth has plate tectonics, so it has a varied landscape, it becomes clearer and clearer that Whether or not all these factors really mattered, a lot of things need to go right in order for life to happen. I'd say 1 in 100,000, quote-unquote, habitable planets evolve life. Now, of the planets that evolve life, how many of them evolve intelligent life? Once again, I'll say the chances are low because, once again, it's taken us a long time for intelligent life to show up. If aliens had visited Earth at basically any point in the past 2 billion years, they'd have said, this planet has life, but not intelligent life. Intelligent may not actually be the best word for what we're talking about here. The eventual goal of this exercise, spoiler, is to calculate our chances of ever making contact with aliens. Whales or octopi might qualify as intelligent life, but as they are, they're not sending out a message to extraterrestrial intelligences. Only humans can do that. So I'll say technological instead of intelligent. Like the evolution of life itself, the evolution of modern humans almost definitely relied on a lot of intersecting factors. Everything from Earth's place in the galaxy to the cycle of ice ages to the existence of a magnetic field have been proposed as influencing it, and I guess I agree. After all, I wouldn't want to live in a world without the magnetic fields. Papa Was a Rodeo and 100,000 Fireflies are the two greatest songs ever written. And what if a meteor, like the one that killed the dinosaurs, had hit right when Homo erectus was starting to evolve into Homo sapiens? Then we wouldn't have had technological life and the clock would have been set back millions of years. Or, to take things in the other direction, how about that fascinating theory that, you know, there's no evidence for, but no strong evidence against, that there could have been an advanced civilization on Earth millions, possibly billions of years ago, so short-lived in geological time that today, not a single relic of it remains. Because of all the things that could have gone wrong, I'll once again say 1 in 100,000 for the possibility that life develops a society capable of communicating across space. After all, there's only one such species on our planet, and there probably has only ever been one. Of technological species that do manage to get past those filters, how many are sending signals that we can detect out into space? That would probably mean radio waves. Alien civilizations might use some other long-distance communication technology that we aren't aware of, but radio waves are intuitive. They're a natural force that's easy to harness for our communication. I bet an alien civilization at a 19th century level of tech would have an alien Marconi who discovers you can use radio for messages. I'd say that maybe 20% of alien civilizations that are advanced enough to have any kind of long-distance communication have radios. 0.2 is our next term. And how long do these civilizations last? Some of the more neurotic individuals calculating this kind of thing say as low as 300 years, based on the duration of previous human civilizations like the Romans. But are those whole civilizations or just empires? Usually when a historic empire like the Romans falls, someone else carries on their technology. The Byzantines. The Chinese went boom and bust many times, but kept up roughly the same cultural and political systems for millennia. And for the purposes of this calculation, we need to know how long a technology lasts. There have been very few societal collapses that led to an actual lasting reversal in technological progress, and there has never been one that spanned all of Earth. David Grinspoon, who holds the title of astrobiologist at the Planetary Science Institute, and also happens to be the uncle of a friend of mine, which is a total coincidence because he's one of the top authorities in the world on the possibility of alien life, and I'd be citing him in this episode even if I didn't know his nephew. Anyway, he says that a sufficiently advanced society reaches a point of immortality. We're not quite there yet, but once a civilization is well-established enough that it can't realistically be threatened with extinction, which probably means spreading to at least a few different planets, it will last for billions of years, says Grinspoon. And even at the current moment in history, even as everyone panics about 15 different apocalyptic scenarios that are apparently all happening right now, humanity spreading to Mars within my lifetime seems a lot more plausible than humanity going extinct within my lifetime. Even the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs, I think, couldn't permanently devastate humanity. It would kill most of us, sure, but not all of us. So, to be charitable and not pick the most pessimistic possible estimate for all of these questions, I'll say 1 billion If you've gotten past the great filter of developing life and the great filter of developing technology, you deserve it. You last for a billion years. All right, we've got all the terms we need. That's 4 times 1 times 1 times 100,000th times 100,000th times 0.2 times a billion. And that's 0.08. Holy shit. We're alone in the galaxy. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. What I just did is called the Drake equation. Formulated by astronomer Frank Drake in 1961, it aims to calculate how many alien civilizations there are out there that we could conceivably communicate with. You can't really draw any conclusions from it, because as I showed, most of the terms don't have a set answer, and the range of potential answers could be incredibly huge. When Drake himself first calculated the equation at the Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia, he estimated that there could be 100 million civilizations in the Milky Way that we could access. My figure was just 0.08, which would mean not only that Homo sapiens is almost definitely the only technological civilization in the Milky Way, but also that the Milky Way is a fluke. Most galaxies don't even have a single technological civilization. There are enough galaxies out there, even in my pessimistic calculation, that there must be other civilizations, but they're so far away, we may not have any chance of ever establishing contact with them. Even if you take out the requirement that a civilization has to use the same communication methods to be reachable, that would still only bump my number up to 0.4. Still more likely than not for a given galaxy to be devoid of intelligent life. So, how did Frank Drake get such a wildly different answer? He assumed that if a planet was habitable, there was a 100% chance it would develop life, and if life existed, there was a 100% chance it would evolve into intelligent life. That's a far cry from the estimates I used. Now, who's right? Drake or me? Drake has the advantage of having gotten a PhD from Harvard in this stuff, but I have the advantage of having been born 70 years later. After a lot of important space-related discoveries have been made, and having the internet at my fingertips, connecting me to every present-day expert's thoughts on this issue, Drake's vision of a universe teeming with life, and mine of humanity alone in the galaxy, a position sometimes called the rare Earth hypothesis, are on opposite ends of a spectrum in terms of the likelihood of extraterrestrial life. The truth may well lie somewhere in the middle. The early estimates of life being very common in space, in addition to the complete lack of evidence of life on other planets as viewed from Earth, was considered to be a paradox by some scientists like Enrico Fermi. The silence of the stars is still often called the Fermi paradox, sometimes summarized as, "If life is out there, we would have found it by now." But I've never thought of the Fermi paradox as a real paradox. In order to consider it a paradox, you need to believe two things right out the gate: that intelligent life is common in the universe, and that they use similar communications technology to us. Neither of those have any concrete evidence backing them up. Calling this a paradox is rather unscientific. Now, if there really had been phosphine on Venus and microscopic life had been discovered, the Fermi paradox might have become a real paradox, or perhaps more of a scientific mystery we don't know the answer to. Because if there are two places life exists in our solar system, on planets right next to each other, it would mean that life really is common, and where is everybody would become an actually puzzling question. But at the moment, I don't think we can say that. And even if life is common, there's no guarantee it would be easy to find. There's an XKCD comic mocking the idea of the Fermi paradox that shows ants crawling across a kitchen floor. One says to the other, "We've searched dozens of these floor tiles for several common types of pheromone trails. Let's face it, if there was intelligent life up there, we would have seen its messages by now." The comic is captioned, "The world's first ant colony to achieve sentience calls off its search for us." And really, all we've done to find extraterrestrial intelligence is the equivalent of what those ants did. We've searched some stars for signs of technology that we have or that we think we might have in the future. We've searched for indications of biological processes that happen on Earth, such as signs of photosynthesis, which would require the planet to have plants just like ours. We've sent out a few more detailed messages to potential aliens, such as the famous Golden Record containing greetings from Earth aboard the unmanned spacecraft Voyager 1 and 2, and the Arecibo message containing information on humanity, DNA, and math encoded into a binary radio transmission. But the chances of aliens ever discovering these messages are, well, astronomical. Even if there really are aliens all over the place. The Voyagers are drifting off into interstellar space and won't pass within a light year of a star until hundreds of thousands of years from now. The Arecibo message was sent toward the M13 star cluster, 25,000 light years away, and it's very difficult to decipher even for other humans, who know what they're looking for. To an alien, it would just look like gibberish, assuming the aliens managed to even recognize that it was supposed to be an organized message and not a transmission from some weird variant of pulsar, because a lot of things in space other than alien civilizations emit radio waves. We've gotten better and better at discovering potentially life-sustaining exoplanets, with half the known exoplanets discovered since just 2015, but we have no evidence that any of them have life. Or, for that matter, that any of them lack life. Some astronomers have suggested that the smoking gun for finding alien civilizations should be signs of more advanced technology than we can create. What's an example of that? Well, in 1960, right when Frank Drake was working on the Drake Equation, fellow astrophysicist Freeman Dyson speculated that a highly advanced civilization would require huge amounts of energy, and they would get that energy by surrounding the central star of their system with an array of satellites gathering solar power, tapping as much energy as possible from the star. This concept is known as a Dyson swarm, and it became a popular concept in the search for alien intelligence because it would be so easy to detect. It wouldn't be hard to tell from looking at a graph of a star's brightness whether the star is orbited by a vast swarm of satellites. It would dim at a regular rate. Sadly, no stars were discovered with those characteristics. Until 2015! That year, the star KIC-8462852 was observed by citizen astronomers searching for planets by measuring stars' brightness. Most exoplanets are discovered when they transit in front of their star, faintly blocking some of the star's light. But 8462852 didn't dim the way most stars dim. Its brightness dropped by up to 22% at times, and randomly, seemingly unpredictably. Astronomers had never seen a star fluctuate quite like this one. They initially dubbed it the WTF star, later colloquially calling it Tabby's star, after the first astronomer to describe its activity, Tabitha Boyajian. What was happening around this star? Could it be a Dyson swarm? Radio telescopes didn't find any unusual radio transmissions coming from it, but once again, I'm not all that certain that the use of radio is universal. The Dyson swarm hypothesis was just one of many attempts at explaining what was happening to Tabby's star, but it couldn't be disproven. It was the strongest evidence of an alien civilization humanity had come across in decades. With more scrutiny on the star's inexplicable activity, astronomers managed to determine that the star was not orbited by opaque objects, since the infrared light wasn't dimmed as much as the star's visible light. If the infrared was getting through whatever was blocking out the star's light, it couldn't be anything fully solid like asteroids, comets, solid solar panels, or the remains of a falling apart planet. It could only be something with the consistency of dust. Like, for example, dust. The star was orbited by a giant, uneven cloud of dust. Mystery solved. Or was it? Recently, it was discovered that Tabby's star's brightness dipped in a somewhat predictable cycle, 4.3 years long. First in 2013, before anyone had noticed anything weird about the star, then in 2017, and again in 2021. This hasn't been totally confirmed yet, but there's good evidence to back it up. It's not just confirmation bias. This coincides with other shorter, less significant cycles in the brightness, implying that whatever it is surrounding Tabby's star, it has some regular structure to it. It still could be, and probably still is, dust. But we'll have to see what happens this year, when the significant dimming period begins again. Watch this space, literally. This video may be outdated before long. Astronomer Gary Sacco says that if the dimming in 2025, when the 4.3-year cycle repeats, is deeper than it was in 2021, an alien megastructure once again becomes a plausible hypothesis. If it's dust, there would be less dust over time, because it would have to be the result of a planet or asteroids ripped to shreds by the star's gravity, and that's what we've been seeing since 2013. But there are also archives of the star dimming in 1978, and all the way back in 1935, long before the star had officially been named and its mystery hit the astronomical community's headlines. And in both those cases, the dimming is still there, and its magnitude isn't consistent with a constant declining trend. Could it still be dust? Yeah, and it probably is. But it's one of the few cases so baffling that aliens are a legit possibility. That's all fine and good, but how about receiving messages from space? We've sent messages out into space. Wouldn't intelligent aliens do the same? If there are aliens, why have we never gotten transmissions from them? Or have we? On August 15th, 1977, radio astronomer Jerry Amon was looking at a printout of information recorded over the past few days by Ohio State University's Big Ear, a 53-meter radio telescope. Compiled and converted to an alphabetical code by an early IBM computer, Amon found a bizarre signal, far more intense than anything the Big Ear had ever picked up before. On the punch card printed out by the computer, the burst of radio transmission was marked as 6EQUJ5, indicating a very powerful and long-lasting signal, detectable for the full 72 seconds that Big Ear was able to pick it up. Not fully believing what he was seeing, Amon circled the signal on the card, marking it WOW. This became the transmission's nickname in the scientific community, the WOW signal. And all these years later, it's still every bit as deserving of its name. The Big Ear was receiving transmissions from two separate areas of space at that point, out near the constellation Sagittarius. The WOW signal came from just one of the two areas, but we can't determine which. Most suggestions about its origin were fairly easy to rebut. Amon speculated that it could have been a transmission from Earth, bounced off a defunct satellite and pointed back towards Earth, but he later said he wasn't sure a satellite could reflect such a powerful signal. In 2017, several media outlets announced that the mystery had been solved, as an astronomer from Florida, it's always Florida, claimed that it was sent by a particular pair of comets that were in the area the signal came from at the right time. But the entire scientific community rebutted him, saying those comets weren't in that area of space at the time, and comets don't emit waves of that frequency, let alone that much power. But in order to be truly wow-worthy, the wow signal would have to be repeatable. There'd have to be something out in space that keeps sending us that signal. Dozens of astronomers at dozens of observatories since then have tried to recreate the wow signal, but nothing like it has ever been picked up again. This definitely adds to the signal's mystique, but it also means that it's impossible to study and can't be confirmed by the scientific community. Though it's the strongest candidate ever detected for an alien transmission, the true origin of the WOW signal will probably never be discovered. But the most plausible candidate for the human observation of alien technology came swinging through our solar system in 2017. This is the story of Oumuamua. It's kind of surprising how few interstellar objects we've discovered within our solar system. It's known that objects that aren't from the solar system can and do drift past the sun from time to time, but usually they're much too small or distant to be detected. If you're thinking, well, what about comets? Comets don't count. Comets come from the Oort cloud, out beyond the planets, but still part of the solar system. It took all the way until 2014 for a confirmed interstellar object to be identified, a small meteor that had landed in the Pacific Ocean. And some people still dispute that one. But the first widely publicized, 100% agreed upon thing from outside our solar system came zipping into our cosmic neighborhood in 2017. And thing is really the best way to describe it. Named Oumuamua, after the Hawaiian word for scout, which literally means first visitor from far away, it's probably not a conventional comet or an asteroid. Its brightness allowed astronomers to determine its movement, and its movement allowed them to determine its shape, and scientists say flat. It's got a more unusual shape than anything ever detected in the solar system. It's very wide, and it's flat. While the media depicted it being long and thin, which would be weird enough, XKCD speculated that it was a giant eggplant emoji, it was most likely a flat disk, which should spark questions about how it could have formed. And it's shiny, with a high level of reflection. With the world's astronomers watching, Oumuamua said, "Now watch this," and went from weird to weirder. As it zipped away from the sun, moving too fast to be captured in the sun's orbit, it sped up! What force could have caused it to do that is unknown. Comets do that sometimes, because the sun heats them up, making them emit gas that propels them like a rocket, but no outgassing was detected from Oumuamua. Like our other two anomalies, Oumuamua probably was not created by aliens. But we have no idea what Oumuamua could have been, and every hypothesis has holes. Nearly every suggestion has been shot down by other scientists. A popular theory for a while suggested it was a space iceberg, a chunk of frozen hydrogen, a concept never discovered or theorized before until it was thought up to explain Oumuamua. Later it was found that if such spacebergs exist, they can't survive floating through interstellar space at high speeds, like Oumuamua was doing. Avi Loeb, the chair of Harvard's astronomy department, suggested that, amid all the confusion, the most plausible explanation really was that Oumuamua was alien technology. He continues to believe, and keep in mind, this is not Alex Jones, this is Avi Loeb, the chair of Harvard's astronomy department. He thinks that Oumuamua was a solar sail, a form of spacecraft that uses a gigantic mirror to harness radiation from stars for its propulsion, the way sailboats harness the wind. Solar sails aren't hypothetical. A few experimental solar sail spacecraft have been built on this planet, and solar sails have been speculated as an ideal propulsion system for a slow, long-distance unmanned spacecraft sent to study distant planets. Loeb says he believes this is exactly what Oumuamua was, an alien probe sent to cruise past our solar system to gather data on whether there was anything worth studying there. And given that Oumuamua definitely got close enough to Earth to notice weird things going on, the Oumuamuites might be back before long. Unlike the WOW signal, we may yet discover what Oumuamua, which I'm not making this up, my laptop suggested Yo Mama as an alternate spelling for, we may yet discover what Oumuamua was. It's well on its way out of the solar system by now, but we do have the technology to launch an unmanned probe to catch up with it. And that's exactly what the UK's Initiative for Interstellar Studies wants to do. Their Project Lyra intends to launch a spacecraft about the weight of a 10-year-old, with one of SpaceX's Falcon Heavy rockets, which can catch up to Oumuamua and land on it within 26 years. It's not clear whether this project will go ahead, and there's no scheduled launch date, but a lot of prominent scientists are on board. Speaking of Avi Loeb, he has an entertaining answer to the so-called Fermi paradox.
I think Fermi was showing arrogance in saying, where are they? Where is everybody? You know, if you hold a party and nobody shows up, you can say, where is everybody? And obviously, the reason nobody showed up at your party is because you're not very interesting. You know, why would they show up? I mean, why would they care about you? You are assuming that you are so important that they must come and visit you if they exist out there. But they can have their own parties.
And that is one of the speculated reasons why, if extraterrestrial life is common, aliens haven't visited us. Maybe we're just not very special. The nearest aliens may have a technological head start of millions or even billions of years on us, especially if the star they orbit is older than the sun, so to them, we're just like ants or bacteria, meriting a flyby with one of their cheap solar sails, but not much else. Maybe they have their own version of the Drake Equation, but a different bar for what constitutes intelligent life. To back up my theory about intelligent life being rare, I like to imagine aliens visiting Earth during the time of the dinosaurs. They'd see a world teeming with life, but no civilization. Well, what if the aliens would say the same of Earth today? Intelligence is, after all, subjective. The use of tools and technology really isn't, but it's possible that there are aliens so advanced that they consider making the jump to using tools as a step as primitive as the jump from unicellular to multicellular life. It's a start, they'd say, but there's a long way to go before those Earthers really become advanced. Others suggest a much darker twist on the Fermi paradox. To once again quote XKCD, imagine you're a scuba diver looking at the ocean floor. You know there's a fish there, but you can't see it. Why? Maybe the fish looks like sand. And what does that tell you about the ecosystem? This is known as the dark forest theory, after a book by Chinese sci-fi author Liu Shuqin. Maybe advanced civilizations know that contact with other species is dangerous, so they find ways to hide. After all, when civilizations have met for the first time on Earth, it's rarely gone well, especially if one has a technological advantage. Under this scenario, alien civilizations may be fully aware of us, carelessly transmitting our radio signals out into space, naively unaware of the real reason we've never picked up a confirmed radio transmission from aliens. Or maybe advanced alien civilizations haven't made contact with other species, not because it really is dangerous to send messages out into space, but because they have their concept of the Fermi paradox too, and they've come to believe that the dark forest theory is the most plausible one. Given that the dark forest theory is gaining credence among people who consider themselves serious about space, I'd love to write a sci-fi story that turns the idea on its head, since it's been around long enough that it's ripe to be subverted now in an optimistic way. Imagine a world where the galaxy is inhabited by dozens of advanced civilizations, each aware of all the others, but uncertain if the others are aware of them. Each one thinks they're keeping the other ones in check, and the day any other civilization establishes first contact, it'll spell doom for one or both of the parties involved. They have the technology necessary to cross interstellar distances, but they have prohibitions against ever building it. Then humanity, plucky, gung-ho humanity, reckless in the best and worst ways, develops interstellar spacecraft and immediately sets out to investigate a planet where they've discovered a biosignature, something like Tabby's star, and they make contact with a more advanced civilization, and it turns out it goes just fine. It would be like the Aesop's fable about the prisoner who, after years in jail, finally decides to try the door on a whim, and it was unlocked all along. But I have a favorite solution for the Fermi paradox, or perhaps a second favorite solution, because I really do believe that Earth and humanity are rare, and alien civilizations are unlikely to form. But if we're going to assume that there are plenty of them, my preferred hypothesis is this. A sufficiently advanced society may last forever, but it won't advance forever. At the world's current rate of economic growth, averaged over the past 100 years, in 20,000 years, every atom in the universe will need to have a nation-sized economy. Distant as that may seem, it does seem to complicate claims of billion-year civilizations hanging out in distant parts of the galaxy. What are they doing over the billion years? You can just round that off. The billion years where they aren't growing? Well, the answer could be, that's the beauty of them. They aren't doing anything. And in much, much nearer terms, the world's population will probably peak within the 21st century. All the mid-20th century fears spread by folks like Paul Ehrlich about fighting for survival on a planet of 30 billion people and calls to maintain humanity under 500 million are awfully passé. We reached 8 billion in 2022, but we might never even reach 10 billion. This is mostly for positive reasons. The more women go to college, the less likely they are to have children. The higher your living standards are, the fewer kids you have. In nearly every impoverished country, the decline in infant mortality over the past 50 years has been met with a corresponding drop in fertility. As families are aware, they don't need to have as many children to make sure some survive to adulthood. Medicine is a lot better these days. We aren't implanting goat testicles into human testicles anymore. By the end of the 21st century, if the present trends continue, most countries will have fertility rates below replacement. What happens then? Well, we'd need to significantly reshape our economy. Our entire economic system is based on the idea that growth is the norm. Ultimately, though, economic growth is based on population growth. I doubt we'd be able to sustain a perpetually growing economy under a gradually shrinking population. Living standards won't fall, but there won't be much more technological progress, since that, too, is based on the need to deal with growth. The peak in human population is an endpoint to the future. A boring utopia, you could say. And from then on, we wouldn't have a reason to swarm off into space like a horde of angry locusts. We'd have everything we need here on Earth. There are ways this trend could reverse in the more distant future. Some unfathomable technology could make us immortal. But cultural values are very strong. Whether you're on a squalid raft bobbing across the Atlantic or living in an abandoned subway tunnel far below New York, we are bound by cultural norms and pressure to conform. And by that point, after what would most likely be centuries of declining population, population growth would be looked on extremely negatively. Systems would be put in place to make sure the population doesn't grow again. I don't want this future. I believe in a world of embiggening, one where we're always pushing forward until there are no worlds left to conquer. In the nearer term, I wish we still did world's fairs. Events where people can go and marvel at the new ways technology is going to improve their lives, all presented without a shred of shame or irony, the carousel of progress animatronics proudly singing there's a great big beautiful tomorrow. Forever. And people take their kids to gawk at this celebration of human ingenuity and don't immediately go home and write op-eds about how this is a dystopian attempt by the out-group to enslave us with worthless, useless technologies that won't work, and if they do, it'll be worse. For that, we don't need technology to change, we need culture to change. I want a world where humanity bad and progress bad aren't considered ready-made, thoughtful, incisive takes. But history is not on my side. Nearly all the cultural change over the past century has tipped us toward a world where small is beautiful, the tall poppies are suspect, and in every quadrant of the political compass, growth is something to be fought and feared. I don't see that reversing. Even if we get super intelligent AI, I nonetheless think that no technology, not even that, can be more powerful than our shift away from having a culture of doing big things. We are on a track to a boring utopia, a comfortable retirement from progress. Possibly by the end of this century. And I guess I've made peace with it. Now, will all these things apply to aliens? I don't know. They're aliens. After all, they may potentially be even weirder than Timothy Dexter. But reproduction is one of the few things we can be pretty damn sure any aliens we find will do. It makes sense that the same rules would apply to their reproduction, whether or not they have sex or gender like we do. The rule that the wealthier you become, the fewer children die in infancy, and the fewer children die in infancy, the fewer children you have, and the fewer children you have, the closer your population comes to hitting a peak and then declining, seems like it would be universal. So maybe that's why we don't see any evidence of aliens trying to reach out to us. Maybe there's a point where every civilization stops growing and becomes comfortable, peacefully declining in population. They might still be out there, just uninterested in exploring. Or maybe they are very much interested in exploring. Maybe they're exploring Earth right now. One major historical event that has happened over the past decade or so, one that I'm kind of surprised people aren't talking about more, is that the Pentagon officially made a statement along the lines of, yeah, there might be aliens looking at the Earth, who knows? And people were just okay with that. To be fair, a lot of other major historical events have happened recently. But that's a big deal. In 2021, the US Department of Defense released the results of decades of research on well-confirmed, baffling accounts of UFOs US military servicemen had seen and in some cases even videoed. The investigation was under wraps for years, and the purpose was to investigate if they were secret Russian or Chinese technology. If they could confirm that they weren't that, that was all they needed to do. The military termed the object seen by the service members UAPs, unexplained aerial phenomena, which, of course, means the same thing as UFO, but the acronym UFO had too much conspiratorial baggage. The Pentagon wasn't about to take UFOs seriously, right? You gotta call them something that sounds more technical. By now, the euphemism treadmill has done its work, and if you hear someone calling UFOs UAPs today, they're actually more likely to be a crank who thinks aliens are popping out of their toilets, because those kinds of people have cottoned on to the UAP acronym, making them sound like less of a crank to the public. In my personal experience from, like, looking at YouTube videos of stuff people claim are UFOs, people are more likely to be faking it if they call them UAPs than UFOs. Because if someone says they saw a UFO, they're an ordinary person. But if someone says they saw a UAP, that means they were already someone who thinks a lot about UFOs before they supposedly saw one. The most notable UFO case investigated by the Pentagon was the USS Nimitz sightings. In 2004, the aircraft carrier Nimitz, doing training exercises about 100 miles off the coast of San Diego, sent out two fighter jets to go check out some strange radar readings another ship had reported. Something in the air had been ricocheting from 80,000 feet up all the way down to the surface of the sea in less than a second. This had to be a radar glitch, everyone assumed, especially since they weren't hearing any sonic booms. The two pilots, each backed up by a gunner in the back seat, didn't expect to find anything. But they found something. Out in the area the radar readings had come from, they came across a white, capsule-shaped aircraft, hovering above the water, visibly agitating the patch of ocean under it the way a hovering helicopter would. As they watched, the aircraft, which they said looked like a tic-tac, darted around left, right, up and down for a few minutes as if it was showing off how much more maneuverable it was than the Navy planes. Then, without warning, without any sound, it launched itself off into the distance, disappearing over the horizon in less than a second, moving faster than anything these Top Gun pilots had ever seen. The Pentagon investigated this alongside 144 accounts of UFOs they deemed plausible. In 2021, in response to pressure from Congress and the public, especially an organization run by former Blink-182 guitarist Tom DeLonge, who leaked blurry videos of UFOs, including the Nimitz one, to the New York Times, they released their conclusions, and they didn't have any conclusions. None. Bupkis.
The theory is it's basically a mystery.
That's
right. It's like, I mean, the military will never tell us what they were up to.
That's literally what they said, pretty much. They had five theories of substantially varying interestingness: junk drifting through the air, natural atmospheric phenomena, classified US technology, classified foreign technology, and other, which they specified does not rule out aliens. Let's go through these one by one. Obviously, one and two could explain most of them. While the famous footage released by the New York Times is still unsolved, another raft of military UFO videos released in 2023, long thought to be mysterious, were identified as commercial aircraft. Three? I mean, it's sort of a self-own to even claim that. What, you've lost track of your own top secret projects? You're willing to admit that there's that little communication between military branches? Come on. If these really were secret Pentagon projects, you'd deny them. You'd say you're not sure what these are, but you know they're not US tech. Don't leave that plausible deniability in there. Like, imagine your friend invited you over and served you some delicious food you'd never heard of before, and you were like, "Did you cook this?" And your friend was like, "Maybe I cooked it. Maybe I cooked it and forgot I cooked it. Maybe the recipe is so secret that you're not even allowed to know I cooked it. Maybe I'm not even allowed to know." You'd know it was DoorDash. Chris Mellon, who was a high-ranking intelligence official in the Clinton and Bush Jr. administrations, completely discounts the possibility that the tech is American, saying, "If anyone knew, it would be him," and he seems genuinely concerned enough about the UFO issue, both in public and by people who have met him in private, that I don't think he's participating in a cover-up of anything. Three also includes the possibility that it could be private sector US technology, but who has that kind of advanced tech in America and isn't sharing it with the government? Elon Musk? No. SpaceX has been collaborating with the military-industrial complex since it was founded. That's one of its main sources of funding. Four is doubted by a lot of people, too. These UFOs have capacities way beyond what American engineers can imagine. Is any country that much more advanced in its military tech than America? We still do represent most of the world's military spending, after all. I bet you're expecting me to say that China could have built these, because I did a whole episode a week ago about how Chinese infrastructure is so far behind ours, but China most likely could not have built these. Yes, if you go to China right now with its high-speed trains and dazzling new architecture and ubiquitous use of QR codes for everything, it feels more technologically advanced than America, but most of those technologies were invented in the West. The main reason they're not as common in America, as I argued in that video, is because of regulatory issues. Right now, the tech world is losing its shit over DeepSeek, the Chinese AI language model that's on the level of anything Silicon Valley could produce, but that's the thing. Everyone is shocked that the Chinese AI equaled, not surpassed, American AI. Everyone is shocked that it turns out China is on the same level as the US. Every way in which China seems to have better tech than the US is political, not technological. America is still number one. On Earth, that is. And these sightings were in 2004. China was barely a major world power yet back then, and Russia was crawling out of an economic collapse twice as bad as the Great Depression. Several US Navy pilots, who know their shit about aircraft, saw a capsule-shaped aircraft accelerate to unimaginable speeds without a sonic boom over 20 years ago now. No country has aircraft even now that can go supersonic without a sonic boom. NASA is currently testing a quote, low boom plane that just makes a thud, but that's the result of decades of top-notch engineering, and the thing the Nimitz pilot saw was not very aerodynamic and apparently completely silent. What the hell did they see? There's one UFO case that resembles the Nimitz one, and it's a famous one. In fact, the number of parallels to the Nimitz sighting are pretty striking. These pilots weren't the first people to see a white, tic-tac-shaped aircraft that ascended vertically, visibly disturbing the patch of ground under it, and then zipped off horizontally at a crazy speed without a sonic boom. Lonnie Zamora, a Socorro, New Mexico police officer, saw something like that on land in 1964. Today, it's considered one of the most baffling UFO cases, not least because there was physical evidence, burned brush in the desert right where Zamora had seen the thing ascend into the air. Do I really think there's a connection between those cases? No. But it's fun to engage in a bit of wild speculation, and I think the fact that the Pentagon itself is publicly throwing up its hands in confusion gives us a license to do some wild speculation of our own. While SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and the field of astrobiology, that is, the study of aliens that could hypothetically exist somewhere out there, have been legitimate scientific fields for decades, the Pentagon report moved more out there, previously conspiracy-minded lines of thought into the mainstream. If the US military and intelligence services are willing to go on the record and say there could be aliens looking at Earth, who knows what they're willing to say off the record, right? Largely due to the efforts of Tom DeLonge and his group To the Stars Academy, which is explicitly about trying to get the military to disclose evidence of aliens DeLonge thinks they're hiding, the main spokesman for America's new public burst of interest in UFOs is Luis Elizondo. He was the director of the Pentagon's Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, ATIP, and he totally believes that the tic-tac-style craft and other recent UFO sightings are aliens. He's certainly got a legit-sounding pedigree. He has a background of high-ranking roles in Army counterintelligence and was specifically named by Nevada Senator Harry Reid to lead ATIP. But Elizondo hasn't been a full military member since 2012. Other people who worked in the Pentagon have claimed that Elizondo never had as front and center a role as he claimed he did, and lately Elizondo has been going around doing everything short of identifying Frisbees as UFOs. He's been going on a speaking tour, charging $150 to see him talk about aliens. People can send him UFO photos for him to discuss in his talks. One was a deliberate hoax to see if he would fall for it. He did. It was a reflection of a lamp against a window. Still, though, is the military covering up evidence of aliens has become a much less conspiratorial question to ask in the aftermath of this investigation going public. Engineer James Lakatsky claims the government captured one of the Tic Tac spacecraft and he was put in charge of a top-secret program to reverse engineer it. If it's top-secret, why are we hearing about it? Why is James Lakatsky self-publishing books about it seemingly in no fear for his life? Former intelligence officer David Grush has made similar claims, but he's even testified to Congress about how the military is hiding alien tech. Why would the Pentagon let him do that if he was telling the truth? I think if the Pentagon really was hiding evidence of aliens, they wouldn't issue such an embarrassing, "we have no fucking idea" kind of document. If they were hiding evidence of aliens, there's a pretty obvious course of action. They'd publicly say the UFOs are top secret American tech, and force any would-be whistleblowers to toe that line by any means necessary. That way, the public gets an answer that makes sense to them, the UAP people don't trust them, but they aren't going to trust them anyway, and America's enemies are baffled by the advanced technology America claims to have. The fact that they are unapologetically that confused, I think, suggests that the top minds in the world's most powerful military truly are confused. And so, the mystery remains. Yes, maybe we will eventually reach that boring utopia. Yes, maybe the default state of an advanced civilization is for it to have gotten through its brief growth spurt and leveled out at a level of technology below the ability to go interstellar, with a culture that enforces comfortable stagnation and the law of Yanta. Maybe that's the great filter, and someday we'll be in a 17776 world where nothing ever changes again. But boy, oh boy, are we not there yet. Boy, oh boy, are we in a time of rapid change right now, and I, for one, am here for it. In the words of one of the greatest poets of our era, I'm here for an atypical and high perplexity time, not a good time. Keep your eyes to the skies, curious people. The truth, whatever it may be, is out there.
Color of your heart, but the matter.